Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The divinely ordained two guests today. Unusually, however, they'll both be addressing the same subject, Haiti, in light of the UN's approval of a police mission led by Kenya to cope with the horrific gang violence afflicting the country, notably its capital, Port-au-Prince, home to about a third of the population. Jake Johnston will look mostly at the international politics around the mission, as these things are revealingly often called. And then Robert Fatten, a Behind the News veteran, will examine the country's history and social structure. On October 2nd, the UN Security Council authorized Kenya to lead an international police force to try to get some control over the gangs that have been plaguing Haiti, one of the poorest countries in the world, for years. There was a moment of hope in 1991 when Jean-Bertrand Aristide, a progressive priest, was elected president, but he only served about 7 months before being overthrown in a coup. He returned to office during the Clinton years, but under the harsh supervision of the IMF, making it impossible for him to carry out any kind of transformative social program. And there's the difference between the two parties, in a nutshell. George H.W. helped overthrow him, and Bill Clinton supervised his return, but only in a symbolic way, given the constraints of the IMF. In 2010, Haiti was hit by a severe earthquake from which it never really recovered. The troubled recovery was complicated by the election, under questionable circumstances, of the singer Michel Martelly, known as Sweet Mickey, as president the following year. We'll hear some of his music later in the show. His administration, which ran from 2011 to 16, was corrupt and repressive, and he's since skipped town from Miami. 5 years later, in July 2021, President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated, and the country has been essentially without a functioning government ever since. The first of my two guests to explore what's been going on is Jake Johnston, Senior Research Associate with the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. He writes extensively on Haiti for CEPR. Jake Johnston. Let's start with the basics. What exactly has the UN Security Council authorized?
Yeah, well, it's a little bit unclear, frankly, right? They've authorized a resolution that provides support for Kenya to lead a multinational security support mission, that's their terminology, to go to Haiti. But what the specifics of that mission actually are remains to be seen.
So this is not an official blue helmet kind of thing, right?
No, that's exactly right. While it has UN Security Council authorization, it is expressly a non-UN force. So again, they're referring to it as a multinational force, but even the specific contributions or makeup of the force remains to be seen. Kenya has committed 1,000 troops. A number of other countries have made more vague pledges about support, but we really don't have a sense of, even of the overall size of what this force might look like.
Russia and China abstained. Why?
Yeah, I mean, this is a good question, right? I mean, I think a lot of people were expecting, you know, the Security Council not to actually be able to get anything passed without a veto. You heard some of the commentary from the Russia and Chinese representatives at the UN this week, where, you know, they're saying we don't disagree with this in practice, but they also did raise significant questions about this force, saying, you know, we were asking about specifics. What's the rules of engagement? What's the plan for withdrawal? And specifically said, you know, it was irresponsible to be approving something without those specifics included. And yet they voted to abstain. It's a big question why, given those concerns, they wouldn't veto it. Part of that is there was clearly a lot of negotiations that went on between all of these actors in the run-up to this resolution. I think a key factor is that it is a non-UN force, and so the UN will not be paying for it. So Russia and China don't have any obligation to take on a direct role in this. In the end, letting the United States take the lead on another intervention in their own hemisphere, maybe the view is it simply just creates more of a quagmire for the United States down the road.
And why Kenya?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think a lot of people are asking that. The most basic reason is nobody else stepped up, right? So the U.S. has spent much of the last year looking for a country to lead such a force. It's been very clear from the beginning that the U.S. did not want to be in the lead of it. Canada was one of the initial choices. Canada backed out, didn't want to do it. Brazil, same thing. And so then it fell to Kenya. It's pretty clear that the U.S. played a very large role in convincing Kenya to take on this responsibility.
And then there are somewhat other Caribbean countries that are going to contribute forces, or that's still not clear?
Yeah, exactly. We've got public commitments to say, you know, we will contribute, we will support this, Jamaica and a few others. But again, what that specifically entails is very much not clear at the moment.
And the funding is unclear as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so because it's a non-UN mission, it's will be funded by voluntary contributions. What does that mean, right? It's not like your normal assessment. It's not funded through the UN. The only country we've seen make any pledges of funding, concrete pledges, is the United States. So the United States says that the State Department will put forward $100 million and the Pentagon will provide $100 million in in-kind support, logistics, and such.
So how'd this come to be? Who is the impetus behind this whole move?
Yeah, it's interesting to look back at sort of the origins of the call for military intervention. Knowing the history of Haiti, the discussion around foreign military intervention kind of feels like it never ends. This is sort of an ongoing loop we've been in for a century, maybe longer, right? But this specific effort really started about a year ago, almost a year ago exactly this week. And the de facto prime minister of Haiti, Ariel Henry, issued a plea to the international community for security support. And this was occurring in a context of increasing anti-government protests, but also, I think critically, his decision to raise fuel prices and a blockade of the main fuel terminal, which led to a really tough situation on the ground. It was clearly also done in coordination with the international community. So it actually got floated by the Secretary General of the OAS, Luis Almagro. And then within 24 hours, the official request from the de facto Haitian authorities came.
De facto Haitian authorities. The country essentially has no government, though, does it?
Yeah, I think that's hugely important in this entire discussion, right? And I refer to it as de facto Haitian authorities. There's not a single elected official in Haiti at any level. So after the assassination in 2021 of Jovenel Moïse, after a power struggle, the international community threw their support behind Ariel Henry, who had been nominated to become prime minister, but had yet to actually take office. And already at that point, Parliament had become dysfunctional. So the prime minister was not going to get ratified by Parliament or go through any sort of constitutional procedures to gain legitimacy. But since that assassination and since Henri took over this role, he's been playing sort of everything, both executive, the prime minister. There's no legislature. There's no functioning judiciary. All the power has been consolidated in one man's hands.
Are there functioning special bodies of armed men, as Engels called them, the police and the army?
Haiti disbanded the military in the 1990s after a long history of military coups, drug trafficking, et cetera, et cetera. That was reinstated a few years ago under the late President Jovenel Moïse, but it's really not an operational force yet, so not super involved in anything. The police force was really a creation as much of the international community as anything else, right? This goes back to prior foreign interventions in the 1990s, where UN and US advisors really oversaw the creation, training, funding, and building up of the Haitian police force. And then during the last UN military intervention, known as MINUSTAH, which lasted from 2004 to 2017, cost over $7 billion. The primary objective, at least one of the primary objectives, was to train and equip a Haitian police force to grow its numbers and make sure that it could take on the job. And so, you know, this idea of training the police, which is, again, part of the rhetoric in this latest UN resolution, something we've seen for 20, 30 years. And yet the state of the force today is abysmal. There's less than 10,000 troops, thousands who have left the country or have left the force in recent years. One little fact, and I think it's really telling, right? We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars, about foreign troops, et cetera, but most Haitian police officers aren't even getting their regular paychecks. That's the state of the force.
Well, you say 10,000. Kenya is sending, what, 1,000? It seems like the scale of the problem is so large that 1,000 or even 10,000 aren't going to be able to do very much. New York City's police department is about 25,000.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think, you know, the numbers themselves are clearly inadequate. Nobody disagrees that there needs to be more done in Haiti to train and equip a better police force and do all these things. For me, right, the bigger reason why this has little chance of success is that security situation, violence that we've seen in Haiti, which no doubt has been awful, is a symptom of a much bigger problem. And sending in foreign troops is not doing anything to address those dynamics. And I think a lot of that comes back to the lack of legitimate governance that we were just talking about.
Whether this is an adequate response or not, the situation on the ground is horrible. So could you just give some of the highlights or lowlights of that situation?
sort of runs the gamut. I mean, the insecurity situation has obviously gotten really awful. There's more than 200,000 people internally displaced from gang violence in Haiti. We've seen huge numbers of rapes and sexual-based violence, kidnappings for ransom, etc. So no doubt the situation on the ground is extremely dire. I mean, it's really hard just to go about one's daily business, daily life, just making ends meet. And that has obviously had impacts on a whole host of other things. The capital, Port-au-Prince, which is where millions of people are living, has been largely cut off from the rest of the country. The roads north and south, the two main ways to get in and out of the city, have been virtually blockaded for years now. And so, again, this has impacts for food distribution, for just basic goods, for everything. Simply getting to a hospital can be extremely difficult if it's even functioning. Schools, some of them just recently opened, many remain closed. And even the ones that are open, you've seen attendance numbers drop to 15-20% of what's normal. So this is affecting every aspect of daily life in Haiti.
What exactly is the U.S. interest here? How deeply involved is the U.S. in this intervention? Is there a strategy behind this, or is this just a desperate response to a crisis and nobody really knows what to do over the longer term?
Yeah, I think it's closer to the latter, which is that they don't really have a long-term strategy or plan, right? And what we've seen with regard to the United States and Haiti time and time again are short-term solutions, band-aids for things that are much broader. But the United States has obviously played a massive role in doing this. I mean, they pushed for it, coordinated for it, got Kenya. They're the ones offering it. They drafted the resolution at the Security Council. They were the ones whipping votes. I mean, they certainly have outsourced this, so it won't be U.S. boots on the ground, but make no mistake, this is still a U.S. mission. And I think when you look at U.S. interest in Haiti, there are many, right? It's easy to look at Haiti and say, oh, this poor country in the Western Hemisphere, small country, what does the U.S. even care about it? But there are significant interests. And I think beyond just those interests, it's also just the role that the United States has played in Haiti for a long time, which is basically one where it's been politically deterministic. The U.S. has been involved in virtually every decision of the Haitian state or the Haitian authorities for decades, right? And so they own this crisis to a certain extent, and I think have some pressure on them to do something. Now, I think when you look at this, right, this is a one-year mandate the resolution offers. Now, what's about 1 year out? The U.S. presidential elections, right? I think for the United States, one of the biggest interests with Haiti is what's the domestic political blowback, right? We've seen this be a concern of administrations time and time again. This concern about Haitian migrants disrupting domestic political objectives, being weaponized by opponents, etc. Right now, you've got this humanitarian parole program. The largest nationality of people actually applying for this program are Haitians, 500,000. Obviously, we've seen the situation on the border and hundreds of thousands of people coming up, many of whom are Haitian. So I think no doubt migration plays a significant role. And having these security forces on the ground, having the military on the ground for the next year, I think for the United States provides some protection against any fallout that might impact politics here.
Yeah, there's also a significant Haitian presence in Florida, right, which is a significant state for presidential politics.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, what's interesting in that regard, about 2 weeks ago now, 10 days ago, you had the largest network of Haitian American elected officials, obviously many of whom are representing at various levels in Florida, send a letter to the Biden administration opposing military intervention. And so you've had other civil society groups, grassroots organizations, Haitian American organizations in Haiti coming out with the same message for quite some time. And so, you know, you'd think if the calculus was narrowly political in terms of Florida, that there'd be more listening to these voices. But obviously, we haven't seen that happen. Now, what this letter suggested, right, rather than going down the road of another military intervention, is that if the U.S. wants to help, here are some things you can do. First, stop propping up this illegitimate government that is the primary driver of the violence you say you care about stopping. And the other big issue is the illegal trafficking of arms. Right, we're talking about armed groups in Haiti that have really sophisticated weaponry. Where's that coming from? It's coming from the United States. Largely Florida, and yet we've seen very little done to actually prevent that flow of ammunition and guns into Haiti. There are a lot of steps folks have been telling the U.S. to focus on before going to a last resort option like military intervention, and yet for the last year, it seemed as though that military intervention has been the first step.
Speaking of civil society, I noticed that the UN press release on this resolution said the mission was requested by the Haitian government. We've already discussed the fact that barely exists, if at all, and civil society representatives. What constitutes civil society in Haiti, if anything?
What constitutes civil society in Haiti in the minds of the United Nations is a question I'm not prepared to answer, right? Because the loudest voices in civil society, the largest organizations in civil society, the ones that have been the most active in recent years, have certainly been largely opposed to this intervention for one overriding reason. Obviously, there's historical reasons, the failures of prior interventions, sexual abuse, extrajudicial killings, etc., the political influence, but also just most people in Haiti, certainly most civil society groups, are denouncing this because they see it as propping up this illegitimate government. And so again, it seems we have a lot of rhetoric. Oh, we've learned our mistakes from the past. We've done this. We've done this. There's going to be accountability, etc. But I think what a lot of folks are seeing is just repeating these same mistakes, propping up these illegitimate governments and illegitimate leaders. That really, again, goes back to what is driving the insecurity in the first place.
And who are the gangs exactly? Is there some kind of power behind them? Are they freelancing?
Yeah, this is an excellent question. I mean, I think they've changed and they're not monolithic, right? I think there are a lot of different organizations, armed groups, gangs, however you want to refer to them in Haiti. These are not new phenomena. This is something that's existed for quite some time. I think what's clear is that over the last couple of years, certainly large factions of these groups have sort of become less beholden to political and economic actors, right? There's clearly those connections exist. There's no doubt. But I think you've also seen some sort of get powerful enough where they aren't even being controlled or can't be controlled by their initial patrons. So it's adding a new dynamic to that mix. But of course, you know, there are groups that are protecting certain neighborhoods and fighting other neighborhoods. There are some groups that are straight up in the business of kidnapping for ransom to make money, right? I mean, it sort of runs the gamut. There's obviously a huge factor, which is, again, I mentioned earlier, right? Nearly 3 million people in the greater Port-au-Prince area. A lot of discussion around elections. We have no elected officials in Haiti. Elections are going to take place at some point. And that sort of scramble for control ahead of that electoral process stokes that violence. It stokes actors to start funding armed groups, to start working with armed groups, to try and control neighborhoods and control the vote. And so, you know, that's certainly a dynamic as well.
President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated a bit over 2 years ago. Do we know at this point, after all that time, why and by whom?
Yeah, this remains a great mystery, right? There's a case going on in Haiti, and there's a parallel case going on in the United States. With the United States case, we have had, a few people have pled guilty. But I think what's clear is that, well, we have some idea of some of the actors who participated in that plot and in that assassination, we still have very little information regarding what the ultimate motivation was, who the ultimate masterminds were, who financed it, etc. What we do know is the involvement of a South Florida security company that hired 20 or so Colombian former soldiers that were in Haiti, and one of whom has pled guilty to his role in the assassination. But who they were ultimately working for, who was ultimately controlling that, remains a big question. And, you know, this gets back again to this issue of governance. The acting prime minister, Ariel Henry, has himself been implicated in that assassination. There were phone calls between one of the primary suspects, Joseph Baggio, and Prime Minister Henry in the hours after the assassination and in the weeks leading up to it. When one of the prosecutors called Henri to answer some questions, he refused, asked the justice minister to fire the prosecutor. And when the justice minister refused to do that, Henri fired them both, right? And so I think there's very little hope in terms of success on the Haiti case, on the assassination case inside Haiti. And likewise, on the United States side, that case is focused almost exclusively on these ties to South Florida, which certainly relevant to the overall story, don't actually address the fundamental questions of the mastermind. And those are the questions that actually have political ramifications in Haiti, right? And so the U.S. case pretty expressly is not going after the masterminds. It's not an investigation into who carried out this assassination. It's just narrowly focused on the South Florida connections.
The question one always asks for the crime is who benefited from it? Who did benefit from this assassination?
Well, look, I mean, I think we're 2 years after the assassination. One person's been in power the entire time with almost no checks and balances and nobody else. And that's Prime Minister Ariel Henry. Now, of course, that's not just him alone. There's those he's working with. When you look at who benefited from the assassination, there's a certain faction of the opposition to Jovenel Moïse that has now joined Henri's government and is participating in the government. So certainly they are a part of that story. But it's not just the opposition to Jovenel Moïse, right? There are internal power struggles going on there as well. And so this sort of new coalition that you've seen backing Henri is sort of a mix of a certain segment of the former governing party, close to former President Michel Martelly, who had picked Henri to be prime minister, as well as a certain segment of the opposition, which has now joined the government as well. So certainly in terms of the political reality, you know, those are the actors that have seized that opportunity.
The U.S. is deporting people back to Haiti in the midst of all this chaos.
Yeah, it's exactly right. I mean, this has been continuing unabated since the Biden administration took office and obviously before. At this point, since Biden took office, there have been roughly 30,000 individuals deported to Haiti. The UN Security Council just authorized a military intervention into Haiti because of how dire the situation is on the ground. And yet you're still sending planefuls of people from the border, U.S. southern border, back to Haiti, right? I mean, this is something that's been denounced by basically every major rights organization, immigrant advocacy organization in the country, as well as dozens of members of Congress, senators, et cetera. And yet the policy continues. And I think this is one of the many sort of hypocrisies regarding U.S. policy towards Haiti.
The problems of Haiti go, you know, way, way back to the time of the revolution and France's punishment of Haiti for the revolution. It's gone on for centuries. Is there any way to address the structural issues that, you know, have these deep, deep, deep historical roots? It seems almost insoluble when one looks at it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a challenging question, right? But I think, you know, you need to sort of take a step back, right? It's not up to the international community to solve Haiti's problems, right? It's not up to the international community to provide Haiti with a development path. Haitians are perfectly capable of doing that, right? And I think the problem has not been their ability to do so. It's been that those international interventions have prevented that from happening. We're talking about this today in a way where the UN has authorized an intervention. And it's sort of framed like as if there's not an intervention already, right? As if the option is to let Haiti burn or intervene and do something. But the reality is that the international community is intervening in Haiti every single day. And this goes back to the political support for the government, to the fact that there's a core group of diplomats that started in 2004 with the last UN occupation that functions as basically a fourth branch of government in Haiti, right? So the international community is all over everything that's happening in Haiti on a daily basis. They're intervening in the politics of that country. And so it's, you know, sort of a little disingenuous to be saying, you know, this is a continuation. This is just an additional part of that intervention. I think the answer is relatively straightforward in terms of the international community's role, right? I mean, are we going to continue to intervene on the behalf of a certain segment of Haitians, traditionally the Haitian elite, or are we going to change our policies to actually put Haitians first, to actually put Haitian needs first, and to stand in solidarity with those movements looking to build a different future? Haiti is going through a huge inflection point right now. And I think you can look at it in a number of different ways. But how I equate it is, you know, similar to the fall of the dictatorship, the Duvalier dictatorship in 1986. It took about 4 years for there to be an election, a free and fair election that saw the rise of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. That was a long process. And it was about building something new from a failed system. The democracy that we've seen in Haiti over the last 30 years has been virtually outsourced to the international community, to NGOs, right? There is no state. That existed before the assassination of the president. The state's been outsourced. It's been controlled by international actors. I think the question now is, do you try and put that state back on the tracks, right? Get things back to where you were a few years ago? Or do you try the hard work of actually letting Haitians build something new? And I think that's the prospect that really scares the international community in the United States. They want to get the train back on the tracks. But that train was unsustainable to begin with. It was always going to lead to this. And so that's the fundamental sort of divide right now in the real battle going on in Haiti. Is what's that future going to look like and who's going to be the ones actually calling the shots?
That was Jake Johnston, Senior Research Associate with the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. With the last question, I certainly wasn't longing for some sort of foreign rescue for this long-suffering country. Foreign imperial interests, notably the U.S. and France, are responsible for most of its suffering. But looking at Haiti's situation now, its profound lack of resources is a substantial obstacle facing any sort of reconstruction, even if it's approached with virtuosic skill and political seriousness. That's what makes it so hard to find a way out. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Et puis, sac pas content. Some of I Don't Care by Michel Martelly, a.k.a. Sweet Mickey, who served as president of Haiti from 2011 to 16. And now for a longer-term Haitian perspective, we turn to Robert Fatten, a professor of government and foreign affairs in the Department of Politics at the University of Virginia. His latest book is The Guise of Exceptionalism, Unmasking the National Narratives of Haiti and the United States, published a couple of years ago by Rutgers University Press. His 2002 book, Haiti's Predatory Republic, is an excellent primer for understanding how the country, led by an elite whose major occupation is looting the state rather than running a profit-seeking capitalist economy, got to this miserable place. In his first response, Fatten refers to the assassination, that is, of Jovenel Moïse in July 2021. Note that he mentions that Kenya's leadership of the intervention may have been lubricated by some quid pro quos with the U.S., in order to promote Washington's security interests in Africa, a topic we've been covering on Behind the News. Now here's Robert Fatten. The UN resolution, what do you make of that?
The U.S. and the current government in Haiti have been trying to find a solution to the crisis that we've had for a long time, but which has been exacerbated by the assassination, then by the proliferation of gangs, and the gangs have taken over. And I think the U.S., for political reasons, was interested in establishing some kind of a modicum of security. And they shop around. They went to Latin America. That didn't work. They went to Canada. That didn't work. They went to Mexico. That didn't work. And then they suddenly discovered Kenya, which is a very bizarre choice to lead some sort of a mission, military mission or police mission, however they want to call it, to go to Haiti and assume it will get there by January. And the idea is to tame the gangs or eliminate the gangs. Now, all of that, I think, is a bit bizarre, because if you look at the current government, it's a completely illegitimate government, unelected. There's no one elected now in Haiti. But the government has been completely incompetent and very corrupt. So you have a government that has no legitimacy, and then you are sending troops to essentially support that government. And not surprisingly, many members of the opposition are not happy about that, and they would have preferred if an international mission were to have been created to come to Haiti, that there would have been a different type of government, a government essentially of national unity that would be more representative of the Haitian population. So the mission would have some legitimacy. Now, there is no doubt that the situation in Haiti is critical. The gangs are not a new phenomenon, but they are controlling now probably 60 to 70% of the capital city. They have really did some horrific thing to, in particular, the poor people in the slums. Something like 200,000 people have lost their home. At least 70,000 people who are internally displaced, and they live in the streets of Port-au-Prince. The economy has fallen apart. There's a humanitarian crisis. Some people, on the other hand, say, well, we hate the idea of an international mission, but what else can we do given that the government can't solve that issue of security? And obviously the problem is that once you have an international mission and once they leave, nothing will have changed, because they are not addressing the fundamental issues confronting the country. And those issues are the ones that are responsible for the gangs.
Who are the gangs exactly? Who's behind them?
Haiti has always had gangs. Even in the 19th century, big men, as it were, people with some money, would create their own militias. And that pattern has persisted. Now, the gangs really reemerged in the aftermath of Aristide's overthrow in 91. You had the police, and then you had a militia that was created actually with the help of the CIA to essentially eradicate what they would perceive as the Aristide's virus. And there was a tremendous amount of violence. And when Aristide came back, he essentially created his own gangs. And then that generated, on the part of the elite, the economic elite, the creation of their own gangs. So yeah, the proliferation of gangs by the time Aristide was again forced out in 2004. This is when you had the MINUSTA, the first major UN mission in Haiti. And MINUSTA established some order, eliminated some of those gangs, but the gangs were still around. They went underground, as it were. They were hiding their weapons, etc. And then you had the earthquake, then the election of Martelly's with Mickey, who apparently had connections with the gangs, and everyone was arming the gangs. Now, the gangs are, to a large degree, financed by people who have money and by drugs. And the two are more or less connected. And you have also members of the police who are involved in the gangs. And actually, one of the leading figures of the gangs is a fellow by the name of Cerisier, and he has that surname of Barbecue. And Barbecue was a police officer. And he had problems with the police, corruption problems, etc. So he decided that he would become a leader of the gang. And he's probably the key figure in the gangs. There's a proliferation of gangs. There are about 200 gangs in Haiti, but some of them are more important than others. And they federated a few years ago, and they have two major kind of forces, one headed by Cerisier, and the other is headed by a fellow called Gabriel Jean-Pierre, who's called also T. Gabriel. And his gang is called G. Peuple, in other words, the eyes of the people. Whereas Barbecue Cerisier, he has a federation of nine gangs, and it's called the G9 Federation. Those are the main gangs, and they are smaller ones, and they are fighting for control of their own turf, expanding it, etc. So that's why you've had so many confrontations between the gangs. And the gangs now are composed of people mostly from the slums, young fellows who don't have a job, don't have any future. And they join the gang sometimes under duress, but sometimes just to make money. They are given guns. And that phenomenon has been exacerbated in the last 2 years. Because the gang never controlled all of Port-au-Prince. Now they are virtually controlling all of Port-au-Prince. And there is a very symbolic event that shows that. The current Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, I think it was last year, he wanted to celebrate the anniversary of the founder of Haiti, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, when he was assassinated. He tried to go there, and Cerisier decided that the Prime Minister wouldn't get there. So he had to withdraw from the convoy, go back to his house, and 2 hours later, Cerisier came with flowers, guns, made a speech on YouTube. That tells you that there is a real vacuum of power.
It seems like 1,000 Kenyan cops or troops or whatever they are exactly are really no match for the force of the gangs.
I don't know. You know, it's an interesting question because it may well be that the gangs look strong simply because the police is so incompetent and ineffective. The police in Haiti now is reduced to about 9,000 police officers. And those who are in charge of confronting the gangs don't number more than 3,000. And they are ill-equipped. Actually, the gangs now have better weapons than the police. So it may well be that if you have a contingent of Kenyans, and apparently there are 12 other countries which have promised to send people, you may get to 2,000. It may intimidate the gangs. This remains to be seen. But the problem, obviously, is that the gangs know their territory. All of those Kenyans and Jamaicans, they really don't know the Haitian terrain. They don't understand Creole. And in addition, the Kenyan police is hardly the most effective police in the world, and it's also very repressive. They've had riots a few months ago, and at the time of the elections, and the police is really very much like the Haitian police. So I'm not sure that they're going to resolve the problem, even in the short term. Because the only thing that can be resolved in the short term with that mission is the reestablishment of some type of security. But in the long term, nothing has been planned. I mean, this is a very ad hoc mission. I think it has to do with American politics, immigration, and the election that is coming, and they don't want to have a massive crisis in Haiti at the time of the election. And there are also strategic reasons. I mean, what is interesting to see is that the Kenyan government and the U.S. government signed an agreement. It's essentially a security agreement. And just after that, the Kenyans decided to send the troops. So there must have been some exchange of favors on the part of the Kenyans to sign that security agreement. And it has to do, obviously, with the problems in the Horn of Africa and with Somalia and the Congo. And to be fair, the Kenyans have also had missions in the Congo and in Somalia. That doesn't mean that they are that effective in any case, but they have some limited experience in terms of areas of conflicts.
To turn to a topic we've discussed frequently over the years, the Haitian elite. First of all, what is their reaction to all this violence and anarchy?
What they do is that if they can, and most of them have enough money to escape, they go to the Dominican Republic, or they go to Miami, or they go to Spain. They have an exit option. Those who stay in Haiti, they have private security. They have special houses, special cars, etc. But they can always exit. The violence has also been an opportunity because whenever you have a crisis, some people are going to benefit. So some members of the elite have benefited. On the other hand, the Canadians and to a lesser extent the U.S. Have imposed sanctions on some key figures of the economic elite and the political elite. For instance, the former prime minister, a fellow by the name of Laurent Lamotte, has been sanctioned by Canada. The former president, Prévert, has also been sanctioned. Some key figures in the banking sector have been sanctioned, and that is creating some significant problem for the elite. On the other hand, those are the very people who deal with the government. They are the very people who ultimately deal with the UN and the United States. Paradoxically, for instance, Michel Martelly, who's been sanctioned by the Canadians, lives in Miami and he goes occasionally back to Haiti. I don't know how serious the sanctions are. I don't know if at least the Canadians mean what they say. It's clearly the first time that elite has been sanctioned since the overthrow of Aristide in 1991. Their lifestyle has changed to the extent that many of them have opted to go to the DR, the Dominican Republic, and a few are in Miami. Now, if you impose travel sanctions and you impose economic sanctions, that could cause a problem. Some of the key members of the elite can no longer go to Canada. So that has presented some problem for them. What is puzzling, obviously, is that the country has reached a point where life is quite miserable, not only for the very poor, but also for the wealthy, because just going out in the street is kind of dangerous now. You have more than 2,500 people who've died since the beginning of the year. You've had something like 900 kidnappings. So life in a small country, especially in the area of Port-au-Prince, because it's not the whole country which is as affected by Port-au-Prince. But as we say in Haiti, Port-au-Prince is not only the capital city, but we call it La République d'Haïti. So in other words, it's the main core center with a very large population. No one knows how many people live there, but there probably is about 4 million people, which would be at the very least more than a third of the total population of the country.
I'm speaking with Robert Fatten, the professor of politics at the University of Virginia. More on that elite. We've talked in the past about how the Haitian ruling class is fundamentally a kleptocracy with no real interest in classic capitalist economic development. Yeah. Could you remind the listeners of all that and how that figures into the current situation?
Well, this is a very subservient economic elite. It's part of the world system, as it were. There are countries like Haiti, which have very limited productive capacity. Actually, now we don't have a productive capacity. There's virtually no electricity in the country. So the elite is essentially involved in commercial activity, import sector, and politics itself becomes a business in the sense that you win an election or you have power and you use your public office to make money through corruption. That's basically the system. And that has not changed since the very beginning, actually. So you have a kleptocratic elite, and it's an elite that has been associated with the major powers and has an opportunistic convergence of interests with those powers. They try to keep order. They make money, import business. Some of them are involved in the drug business now, in the black market. So that's where they make their money. There is no national project, as it were, in the sense of a classical bourgeoisie. It used to be called, as you know, a comprador bourgeoisie. It really has no hegemony over society. It is not perceived as a legitimate group by the vast majority of Haitians. What has kept it in power is state power.
And it just keeps getting worse and worse.
Yeah, I mean, the last 10 years have been a descent into hell. There is no other way of putting it. You know, you had the earthquake, which exacerbated all of the problems. The so-called reconstruction after the earthquake has been a complete fiasco and has generated a lot of corruption, not only among Haitians, but among a lot of external NGOs and the figures that are not Haitians. So you have that, then you have the economy, as I've said, has taken a plunge because there is no infrastructure left in the country. If we have 5 hours of electricity, it's a lot in the capital city. It's not everywhere the same, but the capital city now has virtually no electricity. If you're wealthy, obviously, you have your own generator. You have your kind of own private little island in the middle of a horrific situation. The main economic activities were exports, small industries, garment, but that has collapsed. There was an attempt to create an industrial sector in the north after the earthquake. The Clintons inaugurated the area. It was called Caracol. It was supposed to bring 50, 60, 70, 100,000 jobs. And at the moment, I don't even know if it's open, but a few months ago, the number of people working there were about 4,000. And that's in a population that is about 12 million. So people have no jobs. People are facing a humanitarian crisis. The agricultural system has essentially collapsed, and that is to a large degree connected with the neoliberal policies that were imposed on the country after the return of Aristide, and actually even during the Aristide period, whereby tariffs were lowered to such an extent, I mean, for imports, that the rice industry collapsed, the sugar industry collapsed. Nothing has changed. So you have growing poverty. It's estimated that something like 6 million people now are suffering from malnutrition and extreme poverty. And the rest is not doing much, much better, except the very small segment of the elite and a very limited, what you might call middle class in Haitian terms.
And it's a bit over 2 years ago that the president, Moïse, was assassinated. Do we know any more about who is behind that and why?
We don't really know. We do know that the Colombians were involved. Some of the members of the Colombian gang, well, they're former officers in the Colombian army, they've been extradited to the U.S. There have been a few trials of a few Haitians. But we don't know who was behind the assassination. And paradoxically, the U.S. doesn't want to talk about that. Even in the trials, they have not given all of the information that they have. As far as I'm concerned, I'm convinced that the United States knows who's behind that. It would be very difficult for me to believe that they don't, given their capacity to eavesdrop into the phone connections between the former president, Jovenel Moïse, and his security guards, etc. As you know, the U.S. has been listening to the private phone conversations of Merkel in Germany, of Hollande in France. So there is absolutely no reason why they wouldn't have all of that, but they wouldn't have knowledge of what the heck happened.
What's the interest of the U.S. of keeping it quiet? Was the U.S. involved somehow?
I don't necessarily think that they were involved, but, you know, if you know who was involved and you want to have some sort of file on potential new leaders, it's always very useful. I don't want to be too cynical, but I think that's the way things work. When you look at the former presidents, for instance, Michel Martelly, not only was he not fit to be in office, he was just a singer, a very popular singer, but just a singer, and he was involved in all kinds of corrupt practices. You look at Lamotte, who was also apparently involved in all kinds of corrupt practices that goes back to his economic involvement in West Africa. Those guys became prime ministers, they became president. Jovenel Moïse was known also to be fairly corrupt, and he became president. So if you have files on those guys, you can literally bargain, as it were, from a position of strength.
Whatever happened to Martelly, sweet Mickey?
Martelly is living in Miami. And what is interesting, I mean, yesterday you went back for a day to Haiti because there is a new judge who's looking into the assassination of Jovenel Moïse, and he testified. I'm not quite sure what was the substance of that testimony, but that was yesterday. You know, he lives in Miami, so this is very interesting. There was also a scandal during Martelly's presidency because people had accused him of being an American citizen. If you're an American citizen, you cannot run for the presidency. Very strangely, suddenly, the American ambassador came to the National Palace, gave a press conference saying that Martelly is not an American, and that was the end of it. From all indications, he probably has an American passport. But it's useful. You can bargain, you can threaten to withdraw those kind of things, and that has been a strategy of the U.S. to take away the visas of members of the elite. I think there is a murky sphere there in the relationship between the U.S. and the Haitian elite.
Who is the prime minister, Ariel Henry?
Ariel Henry was a doctor, and actually quite a good doctor. He's a neurosurgeon. And one of the reasons that people initially may have had some hope is that he appeared to be unconnected to many of the worst aspects of society and of politics. But very slowly, gradually, we discovered that he had linkages to Martelly. He had linkages to also, obviously, Jovenel Moïse. Looking at the external connections, when Jovenel Moïse died, he had just nominated Ariel Henry to be prime minister, but he was not appointed normally. In other words, there was no parliament. But there was another prime minister by the name of Claude Joseph. And in the aftermath, immediate aftermath of Jovenel Moïse's death, Claude Joseph was ratified, as it were, by the international community as the prime minister. But after a week, suddenly, the UN representative sent a tweet, and this is really an amazing story, sent a tweet saying that Claude Moïse should go and Ariel Henry should be the legitimate prime minister. And 24 hours afterwards, Ariel Henry became prime minister and Claude Joseph joined the government initially. Now he's in opposition to Ariel Henry. That tells you again the kind of influence that the international community, or the core countries as they are called also, has on Haitian internal domestic politics and decision making.
30 years ago, you know, Aristide brought a moment of hope to Haitian politics, but the U.S. and the Haitian elite squashed that. 30 years later, can you see a way out of the present morass?
Well, I'm increasingly pessimistic. I've always been pessimistic, especially after the overthrow of Aristide in 91 and the way he returned and the type of policies that he had to enforce and eventually the kind of very quick decomposition of the earlier optimism and the earlier idealism of Aristide and his coalition. There were moments where I was really in despair in 2004 when Aristide had to leave. That was a very violent moment. And then you had the first large contingent of foreign forces, first the French and the Americans, and then the UN. And then Préval was elected in 2006. And there was a short period of hope. Préval was not the greatest, but he was much better than most presidents we've had. He managed to have some kind of balance of power between the elite, the popular sector, and different countries in the international community. He had very good relations with the U.S., very good relations with Cuba, very good relations with Venezuela, and he was managing that fairly well. And there was the beginning of an economic recovery. There was talk about more redistribution. So there was kind of a flicker of hope. And then you had the earthquake, and everything fell apart. But on the other hand, the extent of the crisis generated by that earthquake made me believe that maybe the elite will finally realize that, that they have to compromise. They may want actually to generate a system that is more representative and more equitable than previous systems. And for a short moment, there was talk about that, and then everything fell apart. And then Martelly was elected, and the battle was lost. With the assassination of Jovenel Moïse, things are significantly worse. And with the gangs now on a new mission, and there is no clear path for that mission, we don't know what the mission is ultimately going to do, if it is going to just be repressive, and if it's just going to be sustaining Ariel Henry. We are really in a very morbid moment where things look very, very bad. It's as if everything is falling apart. No security, nothing that would resemble some sort of, I don't even want to call it democracy, but a semblance of a representative order. The economy that has collapsed, you know, about half the population which is confronting a humanitarian crisis, a food crisis. So there is very little here to think optimistically about the future. Now, history is full of surprises. Things might change, but my pessimism is really very powerful. I mean, Gramsci used to say pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. And I'm not even sure if there is really an optimism of the will in the current conditions.
That was Robert Fatten, professor of politics at the University of Virginia. Fatten mentioned the Clintons' involvement, Hillary as Secretary of State, Bill through his foundation, in post-earthquake reconstruction. It was a disgraceful performance. I wrote about it in my book on Hillary, My Turn. I posted that section to my blog, lbo-news.com. Check it out. So many more reasons to hold these two in contempt. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this. Some more by ex-president Sweet Mickey, this president. Till next week, bye.
See you.